Today, why the government's multi-billion pound response to the COVID crisis has raised questions about a Tory democracy. The Guardian special correspondent, Felicity Lawrence, has been part of an investigations team that for months has been focused on COVID-19 and the lucrative contracts dished out by the government.
I'd had a tip-off about a new supplier making products for COVID test kits who had bought what was called a clean room from a bouncy castle manufacturer.
This is going to be interesting.
It was intriguing from the beginning. I looked at the bouncy castle manufacturer's website, and sure enough, there was a piece on it that they'd written about them as the manufacturer supplying a company called Hinpak.
Hinpak, until the pandemic, was a manufacturer of plastic catering supplies, things like plates and takeaway boxes.
And it turned out that Hinpak had won around £30 million worth of work making test tubes for these government COVID test kits. It had no previous experience in making medical products, which seemed odd.
Felicity did some digging into the company.
And I found quite quickly that the owner of Hinpak was someone called Alex Bourne, who had run the Cock Inn, which is the pub in Thurlow. And the Cock Inn was a few hundred yards from where Matt Hancock, the health secretary, used to have his constituency home. So Bourne was a former neighbour of his. So it was getting more and more interesting. And I could see that the health secretary had been a great supporter of the pub and posted a picture on his parliamentary website of him with Bourne. And they were smiling and joshingly pulling pints together and all looked very chummy. The question arose, did the connection between the two have anything to do with Bourne getting the work despite not having previous experience making medical products, which are quite specialised?
At first, Bourne denied that he'd had any contact with Matt Hancock about COVID supplies. The Department of Health said that ministers were not involved in awarding COVID contracts.
But then a further source from the area said that he'd been told by Bourne himself that there had been direct contact between him and the health secretary over COVID. And when I went back to Bourne with this, he agreed that this had in fact been the case. He changed what he said. He told me that he'd WhatsApped Hancock's mobile at the beginning of the pandemic offering help, and Hancock had replied and told him to go onto the DH contracts portal, which is the sort of formal route for applying to do work for government COVID contracts.
It was in the months that followed that Bourne's company was given that £30 million of work to manufacture test tubes for COVID test samples. He categorically denies he profited from his personal contact with Hancock.
So I went from a bouncy castle company's website to a pub in a lovely country village to the health secretary in Whitehall, and the journey raised lots of questions about the way the government has been awarding multi-million pound COVID contracts.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, why the government is being accused of running a Tory democracy. David Pegg, you're an investigative journalist at The Guardian, and along with Felicity, you've been on this story for months now. It's hugely complicated. There are dozens of characters, a massive paper trail, loads of data. How do you begin to explain it?
The challenge with this is very much just how vast it is. The total cost of COVID to the UK at the moment is something like £280 billion in terms of government measures alone, and the emergency spending on COVID procurement is a very, very big part of that. One way to break it down is to think of it in terms of two distinct areas. The first of those is contracting and procurement. So that's the contracts that the government awards to private companies to help it provide services as part of its response to the coronavirus pandemic. There have been thousands of contracts issued of various sizes since the pandemic began. That's the responsibility of government civil servants working in various departments, but in this instance, principally the Department of Health. The second is appointments. So that's the roles that people running important parts of public services and who gets installed in those positions. That's much more political. Those decisions will principally be made by ministers and usually signed off by Downing Street. What we wanted to do was try to understand whether these appointments and these contracts were being informed by people's political connections rather than their ability to perform, whether it was who you know rather than what you know.
Let's start with contracts. Take me back to the start of this story, which, given that it's all about COVID, I guess is in March. What did the government need to be able to respond to the crisis?
So if you cast your mind back to March, the situation became actually very serious very quickly.
If too many people become seriously unwell at one time, the NHS will be unable to handle it, meaning more people are likely to die, not just from coronavirus, but from other illnesses as well.
The principal challenge for the government was that it wasn't particularly well prepared. Its immediate task was to secure as much PPE, that's personal protective equipment, for NHS staff as it possibly could. What the government needed as a result was vast quantities of face masks, respirators, which is a higher grade of face mask than the ones you or I might wear. It's got a valve in, gloves, gowns, other things as well. There were stories from early on where hospitals were simply unable to procure this stuff. They ripped through their own stockpiles and people were having to use sort of scuba diving masks or bits of repurposed kit that they just found on eBay. There was a huge, huge shortage of it.
So serious the issue of getting hold of stock, the government told NHS staff tonight to start reusing what they have.
Speaking to a committee of MPs online, the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, was asked when healthcare workers would receive adequate PPE.
The answer to that is as soon as possible. And I wish I could wave a magic wand, but I can't.
And so in the first instance, the government's task was simply to get as much PPE as it possibly could. The second big procurement task that it needed to do was the materials for running a test and trace system. The UK doesn't really have any experience of that, so we were at a disadvantage, but we needed to secure huge numbers of supplies to run that kind of system. That involves vials, the actual test swabs, the manufacturing of all of those, the distribution. It involves the infrastructure underpinning the administration of how you run that system. So it's an unbelievably complex task to get something like that running.
And an unbelievably complex task in the middle of a pandemic that was affecting pretty much every country in the world. Presumably, that meant that the rush was coming from everywhere and prices were on their way up.
That's exactly right.
There is, of course, a global supply issue. Everyone is trying to get access to PPE. That is why we're working night and day in terms of making sure we procure more PPE, but then also expand the manufacture here in the UK itself.
And outside of a crisis, how would a government normally go about buying this type of equipment?
Government procurement is pretty tightly regulated. You would ordinarily expect for any contract that's awarded to a private company to go through a process of competition, whereby companies submit a bid saying what price they'll deliver at, what they'll deliver in exchange for that money, and the government will make an assessment of the client's credibility, how likely it is they can fulfil what they say they can do. That's a very standard system that we use to ensure good value for money. As part of that tendering system, there'll be a pretty substantial paper trail. People will submit bids. It has to be properly advertised. And there will be a public announcement as to who has won the bid.
OK. And how did it actually happen in March?
In March, everything had gone completely crazy. And the government had sort of trailed this idea that it wanted to kind of run a little boat strategy where all sorts of people would pitch in. There was talk of getting private companies to adjust what they could supply. And as a result of it, the government was completely deluged with offers from people saying they could manufacture things.
You'll understand that there has to be a process in there. Nevertheless, we want to engage with all of those companies who can help us in this national effort.
What we now know happened is that in an attempt to triage this, civil servants set up what was called a high priority channel, whereby ministers or MPs or other politically connected figures, senior health officials, could refer companies into this system, saying that effectively, this bidder is credible. And those would be sort of treated by civil servants who were having to decide where contracts were awarded as having been kind of pre-vetted for credibility. We now know, off the back of a report by the National Audit Office, which is the government's independent spending watchdog, is that about £18 billion of contracts were awarded, and £11 billion of those did not have any kind of competitive element at all. They were simply awarded directly.
I mean, that is an unbelievable sum of money. What sort of people were bidding for these contracts?
It's really interesting to speak to people who operate in this world, because as well as established companies that genuinely do supply PPE and have a track record of delivering gloves and masks to NHS trusts, you also had this sort of tsunami of Del Boy characters come washing in, claiming to be able to supply trillions of masks or making all sorts of sort of unbelievable bids. People who were frankly chancers, simply moving into the market because there was so much money around. And if they could get a piece of the action on even a single contract, they'd be set for life, because even a middleman on one of these contracts could expect to be paid millions of pounds.
March was a good time to be in the PPE market, basically.
Yeah, it was an extraordinarily good time to be in the PPE market.
Take the price for gloves. This went up 256%. But the government paid its new UK contractors 29p per unit, while it got gloves from old suppliers for just 2p. The price paid for body bags also increased, up 212%, with the government paying some suppliers just £1.69 per item and other companies as much as almost £25.
And interestingly enough, it's not so good now, because the PPE problem is largely solved. The market has slightly adapted to this, and people are a bit better at handling this. So a lot of the people who were sort of swilling around trying to get a piece of the pie have moved on.
OK, so essentially loads of companies were offering their services, some with a track record in making these healthcare products, others who felt their expertise could be adapted to respond to COVID. You might include Alex Bourne, who Felicity told us about in that. And then there were these other characters you're talking about. Tell me which companies caught your eye for one reason or another. Take me through some of the more eye-popping cases.
Some of the contracts that have been discovered, I think, are eye-popping not necessarily because of the value, for the reasons we've talked about. The government simply had to pay this money if it wanted the PPE. But in terms of who they were awarded to, these were very often companies that didn't really have any kind of track record dealing with this field. One of them is Ianda Capital. Ianda Capital is described on its website as a family office, which normally means it's investing large sums of money on behalf of wealthy individuals. They were awarded a £250 million contract to supply face masks. That raised eyebrows because they have never operated in that field, for one, and also because one of the company's advisors is a man called Andrew Mills. He's a businessman who also worked as an advisor to the Board of Trade, which is a government body set up by Liz Truss, the Trade Secretary, to promote free trade deals.
Have you put that connection to them?
Mills was involved in approaching the government as part of this contract, but the position of both the company and the department, when you asked them about it, is that his role wasn't in any way decisive.
And do we know what the supply was like?
One of the other reasons that the Ianda contract raised eyebrows is that it subsequently emerged that some of the face masks they supplied didn't meet government guidelines. It's not completely clear why. It may be because what the Department of Health asked for was not actually what the NHS needed, and Ianda did in fact deliver on the terms of the contract. But the end result was still that a substantial portion of the masks that were supplied under that contract ultimately could not be used as part of the pandemic response.
No one's against acting fast, but acting fast to buy face masks that don't work and spending all that kind of money on that company, which did have a particular connection with the government, seems to a lot of people simply a misuse of public money.
Well, as I said, I wasn't involved in this particular contract. There's obviously a process that all these contracts go through. But when you're in the midst of a crisis and we're trying to ensure that we have enough PPE, whether it was for care homes at the time or the country more generally, it was right to try and do everything we can. And I'm not going to apologise for us reacting in that way.
What other companies are there?
Another of these companies was Pestfix. They were awarded a contract over £300 million for supply of PPE. They're a pest control company, principally.
I was going to say, the name doesn't necessarily sound like it works in the health market.
Yeah, so Pestfix is principally a company that provides supplies for dealing with rodent and vermin control. Now, if you speak to them and say, was this an appropriate contract for you? They argue that part of their job involves PPE. But on the other hand, I think when people saw the name, they did start to wonder why part of the pandemic PPE response was being awarded to a company that sell spikes to go on windowsills to stop pigeons resting on them.
Do we know how their supply was?
Pestfix, according to the National Order Office, subsequently had a similar problem to that with the IANDA contract. Some of the masks that were supplied under the deal were, it was later found, not appropriate for dealing with the pandemic. As a result, they can't be used. Pestfix's position is that they supplied what they were asked to supply.
And a big feature of these contracts is that they weren't properly advertised.
Yes. So one example of this is the contract that was given to a Florida-based jewellery designer called Michael Seiger, who'd set up a business to supply PPE based on his experience dealing with factories in China.
Jewellery designer?
Yes.
Those contracts are now the subject of a legal dispute in the United States between Mr. Seiger and a Spanish businessman he recruited to help with distribution. They show that as part of the first contract, Gabriel Gonzalez Anderson was paid $28 million. That's around £21 million.
You mentioned the National Audit Office, who recently produced a first report on this. What did it tell us about how the government spent all the money?
If you were referred into the VIP channel by a politician or a senior official, you were 10 times more likely to be awarded a contract. So your connections really mattered. Where people had been referred into the VIP channel, there was paperwork missing. Less than half the names of the politicians or officials who had referred them into the channel were properly recorded. In other instances, it found contracts for government work had only been drawn up after the work had already started. So those people were effectively operating on public money without having had the terms and conditions of their contract even written down. I think the picture it presented was not very flattering at all.
Can you give the public assurance that the government has acted in line with best practice public sector standards?
We can't consistently say that, and that's the conclusion we reach in the report.
That's pretty damning, isn't it?
You need those controls in place.
So there could be fraud, there could be cronyism.
Well, we can't conclude on that. And in a way, that's the issue. We can't conclude on that. We need to see the evidence in every case.
Okay, so lots of worrying things about the way that contracts were suddenly dished out en masse. What about jobs? How were they handed out?
So people have started using this word chemocracy to mean jobs being awarded to friends of the people in charge. The concern around some of this is that important roles in how the government deals with the coronavirus pandemic have been given to people principally on the basis that they are friends of the house, if you like, rather than because they've got a great deal of experience dealing with crisis issues of this kind. The two big examples that people talk about with regards to this are Dido Harding, who was made head of the Test and Trace programme, and Kate Bingham, who was made head of the UK's Vaccines Task Force.
OK, tell me about Dido Harding.
So Dido Harding is best known for being the former head of TalkTalk. She's a business executive. Her husband is John Penrose. He's a Tory MP, and he's also the government's anti-corruption champion. So he's tasked with promoting anti-corruption efforts. She is also a member of the Jockey Club, which is a big player in the horse racing world. They run the Grand National and own the grounds at Aintree.
And does she ride horses with people with connections?
So she has previously gotten involved in horse riding with Matt Hancock,
the health secretary,
who is also very keen on horses. He has Newmarket in his constituency. I think he previously had an honorary membership at the Jockey Club himself. There are photos of him riding horses with his jockey get-up on.
I don't know where to go with that. I feel like there's another podcast in that.
Dido Harding was made a peer by David Cameron in 2014. She's been sitting in the House of Lords since then as a Conservative peer. She's named Baroness Harding for that reason. And she was made head of the Test and Trace programme, which would run contact tracing for people who had been infected by coronavirus earlier this year, and was appointed to that position without any kind of competition or open recruitment process.
I mean, you can see why it caused eyebrows to be raised. She's extremely well connected. But I guess so were a lot of people in top jobs. Did she have relevant experience?
Critics would say not really, no. She was made the chair of NHS Improvement in 2017, which is a division of the NHS tasked with improving its efficiency and increasing its performance. But that's not a public health role. Public health is the practice of dealing with things like infectious diseases and tracing them and managing them and getting stuck into the problem on the ground. She doesn't have any background in that regard. And I think for a lot of people who do have public health expertise, it was surprising that of all the people you could have appointed to run what is basically the biggest public health operation for the past 100 years, you went for someone with what was extremely limited health experience.
One expert said Dido Harding's appointment makes about as much sense as Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, being appointed the Vodafone head of branding and corporate image. Why is she the right person for this job? Is she qualified for it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's simply the best person who could be doing this job now.
Is there an argument that these positions are a bit like ministerial positions?
You can make an argument that what she's effectively doing is not doing the public health role herself, if you like. She's running a great big operation to manage lots of other people doing that job. But I think you would still ordinarily expect someone running all of those people to have had experience doing that sort of work before.
And how's she done?
The performance has been pretty mixed. Test and trace has cost a huge sum of money. It's about £22 billion. That's about a fifth of the entire NHS budget in an ordinary year. It's a huge, huge, huge endeavour. According to SAGE, the government's Committee for Scientific Advisers, about 80% of a person's contacts need to be traced if they've been infected by the coronavirus to stop that person's contacts then passing it on and spreading it through their community. In its first few months, test and trace only reached about 55% of people's contacts. I think it's now about 60%. That is substantially less than what SAGE says it needs in order to be effective.
I have had two Farnham residents sent to Bristol for their tests.
My disabled constituent, Ian Kenny, has been trying since the 8th of September to get a home test. I've heard from parents, teachers, a vicar in Luton North, all saying there are no walk-in tests, no drive-through tests, no home kits available when they need it.
Baroness Harding told MPs they hadn't seen it coming.
Well, I think that... I don't think anybody was expecting to see the really sizable increase in demand that we've seen over the course of the last few weeks.
OK, so clearly lots of problems around test and trace. We've all seen the kind of chaos there has been at particular times with it. Have to say, feeling pretty good about vaccines right now, though. Tell me about Kate Bingham.
Kate Bingham is a venture capitalist. She's got a long background working in that field, and she was appointed head of the UK government's vaccines task force in May. So she was given responsibility for securing stocks of all these vaccines that were in development by various endeavours around the world for UK distribution in advance of them being available and being approved, so that when they were available and they were approved, we'd be able to roll them out more quickly.
We don't know if any of these will be effective, and so we are choosing the most promising vaccines across this range of four different formats so that if any one of these works, we will have vaccine ready.
Her supporters say that she does have a background working in pharmaceuticals, and that's certainly true. But I think one of the reasons people started paying a bit more attention to Kate Bingham was that it emerged that she had spent part of her budget on a team of PR advisors. It was a six-figure contract, and the government already has people who do comms and press. You know, as journalists, we have to deal with them constantly, and it's not clear entirely why that needed to be done through another company. There was a second complaint that she had participated in a conference call with various business people, including investors who might be trying to make decisions about which pharmaceutical companies to invest in which she had shown government slides containing market-sensitive information, in particular which vaccines the UK thought were promising. Now, it's important to note that she denies that she shared anything that she shouldn't have during that meeting. The third reason is that she is the wife of another Conservative MP, Jessie Norman.
So once again, some extraordinary coincidence. How has she been doing in the job?
Well, thus far, it seems her performance has been pretty good. The UK has secured stocks of these vaccines that are now coming on stream, and the government's priority now is going to be working out how it can distribute them.
And are the roles that you've just outlined, the role for Dido Harding and the role for Kate Bingham, paid?
No, it's important to remember these are both unpaid roles. So I don't think you can accuse Dido Harding or Kate Bingham of enriching themselves by virtue of having been appointed to these positions. But they are very, very important and prestigious roles. And when this is all over, they will lead on to other things.
And I guess we'll never know, will we, what it would have been like if other people had been given those roles through a more open process. Do we know if there have been other suspiciously cosy appointments?
There have been other appointments that people have commented on, and we've been writing about them for several months now. Just to run through some of the examples, and these did end up in the NAO report as well, there was the case of Public First, which is a polling company run by James Frayne and Rachel Wolfe. They're a husband and wife team who both previously worked for Michael Gove. They were given a contract for polling without competitive tender by the Cabinet Office at the start of this, and there was also no contract underpinning that deal for several months. It was only drafted after they had already started doing the work. Now, they say that's because they were already in situ doing something else and it made sense for them just to carry on. Another company that's been awarded several contracts is a data science and artificial intelligence firm called Faculty. Faculty did some of the work for Dominic Cummings during the Vote Leave campaign. Just by way of full disclosure, it's important that I should flag that The Guardian's parent company, the Scott Trust, has an investments arm that also has a small stake in Faculty.
And any others?
So as well as those smaller contracts that have been awarded to companies with backgrounds or links to the Conservative Party and the Vote Leave faction in particular, there have also been appointments beyond Dido Harding and Kate Bingham that were given to people who were perceived to have connections to ministers. One of them is a woman called Gina Colodangelo, who was made an unpaid advisor to the Department of Health back in March and later as a non-executive director to the Department of Health in September, which is a paid role. She's a director and a major shareholder at Luther Pendragon, which is another lobbying firm. And she also happens to be a friend of Matt Hancock from his university days.
Him again.
Yes. So there is a perception among critics of the government that there's a sign hanging over the door saying you don't have to be a friend of Matt Hancock to work here, but it helps. And the question is whether or not that's fair. I mean, people will make up their own minds.
Coming up, why all of this matters. But first, if you fancy hanging out with me, Rachel Humphreys and Axel Cocoutier, then do check out our Guardian Live event tomorrow evening. We're going to be looking back at an extraordinary year for news, speaking to regular Today in Focus contributors from across the world about COVID, Black Lives Matter, and the US election, as well as the madness of keeping a daily podcast going through a lockdown. It's an online event and it costs a fiver. Go to theguardian.com/live-TIF. I mean, when you lay it out like that, it certainly sounds really bad. But I guess if we are trying to see this for a moment from the government's point of view, they were facing an unprecedented crisis. They needed to fill those high-pressure jobs fast. As you say, many of them were not paid. And maybe they felt there wasn't time for a months-long vetting process. So they got in people they knew and trusted to deliver.
I think that's certainly an argument that you can make up to a point, not just in terms of being pragmatic, but also in terms of what is legal. So with regards to contracts, under the government's procurement rules, there are provisions for emergencies where civil servants can award contracts without competitive tender because they need to move quickly. That's allowed under the rules. What the rules don't make any provision for is a kind of high priority channel whereby you get moved to the front of the queue if you've got a political connection. I mean, that is what the whole of procurement law is intended to prevent. And when it comes to appointments, yes, I think you can argue that people want to appoint people that they know and trust into important roles. But there's a flip side to that, which is that those people need to be the right people for the roles. They can't just be people that you know, because then you're not getting the best performance that you need at a time of national crisis.
We're talking about taxpayer money here and about contracts and processes that should be transparent. And yet it feels as if anything we know about this is being crowbarred out of the government, either by journalists like yourself and Felicity, or through legal action by groups like the Good Law Project. Are you finding yourself obstructed at every turn when it comes to this investigation?
I think some people would argue that this is a perfectly natural way for ministers to have reacted to a problem because of the scale of the emergency. And that as a result, it's not really fair to ask questions about this stuff or make criticisms. I don't think that's right. The UK has, I think the figures yesterday said that we had 75,000 deaths from COVID. That's one of the highest death tolls in the world by absolute figures and by proportion of the population. The spending that we have already carried out for this is in the hundreds of billions of pounds. It will probably approach £500 billion by the end of the financial year. And it probably won't end there either. Somebody's going to have to pay for that, and it's going to be us. There is a real cost to how the government's decisions during these months are going to affect our lives. And where there are questions as to whether or not the government has made decisions based on whether they're the right decisions for the country or the right decisions for their friends, that is going to inflict severe damage on public trust in our democracy and in the way our government works. Lord Evans, who's the head of the Committee on Standards in Public Life, gave a speech, I think it was last week, referring to people being concerned that we were entering an age where standards in public life no longer existed. And he said during that, you can't fight a pandemic if people don't trust the government. I think that's absolutely true. And the problem with the government not getting to grips with this issue and the problem with the government not being transparent about it is that people will stop trusting the government's decisions if they don't think they've been made for the right reasons.
David Pegg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was David Pegg and Felicity Lawrence, and they have more stories coming on all of this, so do check out their work and that of the whole investigations team at theguardian.com. We mentioned earlier that Alex Bourne had paid a manufacturer of bouncy castles and blimps to make him a specially commissioned inflatable structure to work as a clean room for supplies. His lawyers described it as a room that was intended to be comparatively contamination-free, but not medical-grade sterile. They said their client's decision to turn to the Bouncy Castle company showed creative and lateral thinking in a time of crisis. Now, before we go, I wanted to thank you for tweeting us and leaving reviews. Hearing from you makes us happy. And I wanted to give a particular shout out to two people who I think can be described as super fans. One called Papalotis on Twitter, who claimed to listen to 21 episodes in a day. I'm actually not sure I believe you. And Abby Rays, who says she's listened to 6,000 minutes of Today in Focus this year and loved every minute. That is lovely to hear, Abby. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Nicholas Alexander. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.